Well, welcome to another outtake that we are doing with surfcoach.com. We are talking today with Mike Slaughter. Mike is a pastor that's been in the Dayton area for many years, and Mike has a fascinating story that is absolutely riveting, actually, more than fascinating. And Mike is a good friend of mine. We've been friends for how long, Mike?
Two decades. Probably two decades.
Do I owe you money, by the way? I probably do.
No, or two no, or I don't think you do.
Okay. Do you owe me money?
Maybe.
Okay. Well, good to be with you, Mike, and so appreciate you taking time out of your day here to be with us today. And, you know, as you drive north of Dayton, it is an amazing thing. You go through some cornfields. You're out of Dayton completely, and all of a sudden there's this gigantic, on the west side of I-75, this gigantic edifice and a series of buildings there, and you begin to wonder, what in the world could that be out there in the middle of nowhere? And it is your church. And tell us what your church is called and, you know, a little bit about your background out there.
Okay, we're, matter of fact, last weekend we just celebrated 30 years here, and it's a United Methodist church. So Carolyn and I were sitting here by our bishop the last weekend in April 1979, and we had under 100 people in a little two-room country chapel with a $27,000 annual budget. And in my first year here, the church declined by about 30 folk. You know, we went from, you know, about maybe 90 to 60. And God has done an amazing work here. We last year we averaged over 4,800 a weekend on our. Now we have three campuses. Our newest campus we just opened in a hard area, at-risk area in Dayton. We opened it in September, and we're averaging about 264 people there a weekend, which is really, really exciting. So it's been amazing to see the Lord work. 16 miles north of Dayton, which has declined in population in our 30 years here. Forbes magazine has named this one of the 10 fastest dying cities in America and one of the 10 emptiest cities in America. So it's an exciting place, you know, to be in ministry.
Now, Mike, what led you to go there? Was it simply a calling by the bishop, or did you have a desire to go there?
Yeah, no. It was in our system is very much the Methodist came out of the Anglican Church in England, and so we still are very Catholic in how our appointments are made. And so it's just believing that God can work through a bishop's hand. They called me on a telephone. I'd been a youth minister in Cincinnati in two different churches, and they said, "Hey, we've got an opportunity for you." And they moved us to this little country church, which was quite a culture shock at first.
Uh-huh. Did the vision for that church come about quickly, or was it a slow kind of a thing? I know you said it went down by a third in population from 90 to 60 at first.
Did
it,
yeah.
Was that a matter of clearing out the old complainers, or was it a matter of getting vision, or how did that all work out?
Well, I believe, yeah. I think in any movement you go to, the call of Jesus is costly. And most of the churches that we see today, 70% of churches in America are under 100 in attendance. Mm-hmm. And the church is in decline in America. And the problem is many pastors don't have the courage to really put out there, folks, this is what it means to be a follower of Jesus. Mm-hmm. I think we have lowered the bar. We've called people to make a decision for Jesus instead of following Jesus sacrificially in discipleship. Mm-hmm. And so when you put that out there, people are going to leave. And we read the same thing in the sixth chapter of the Gospel of John. We read many of Jesus' disciples withdrew and followed him no more because they said, this is hard. And I really believe that to get bigger, and by bigger, I don't mean fatter. You know, I mean to reach more people for Jesus who will follow him into the world to be his hands and feet. To get bigger, you have to get smaller. Mm-hmm. And that's one of, I think, the first principles, you know, of really creating a movement is to realize you have to have the right folks moving with you. It was like, kind of to me, reminds me of Gideon. You know, he had 32,000 men in his army, and the Lord said, I can't win with those 32,000. Mm-hmm. And he kept whittling it down, you know, to 300. And, you know, I want to find those people who want to be a part of the 300, not the 32,000.
So, but you have grown significantly, though, ironically.
Right.
Even though you've grown small, you grew big.
Right. And I think that we're you know, Christ is moving and the Holy Spirit is moving. People are going to come. But at the same time, we have to realize that, that crowds do not represent the committed. And even with the 4,800 and some, you know, that, that we averaged a week last year, I would hope that maybe 500 or 600 of those folk were committed disciples. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes we do. We confuse crowds with the committed. And one of the problems with the church growth movement in the 80s and 90s is that we overemphasized attendance. You know, it was all the, kind of what I call the ABCs of church, which was attendance, buildings, and cash. Mm-hmm. And those aren't the measurements of the Lord. The measurements of the Lord aren't how many are attending, but how many are serving and reaching the lost, the least and the lost in the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mike, tell us a little bit about, you know, what the vision took you from. I mean, you got down to that small number and then you grew. But did the Lord show you something significant at the beginning that you would grow into? Or did he show you, like, you're going to become this major thing? Or did you just have to grow into that slowly by faith? Or how did that work?
No, I you know, the Bible says without a vision, the people perish. And I believe one of the first things that any church leader needs to do is to really seek God for a vision. Because you become your picture, your life picture. And if you don't have a vision, if that vision is confused or distorted to you, for you, then it's going to be even more so for your people. So we came in April 1979, and we little country church building on a quarter of an acre. They didn't need more than a quarter of an acre. They didn't have parking. They had this little gravel horseshoe that went around the little building there. And so I went out on this land right behind the church. And I said, it was an April day, and it was cool. It was a sunny day, but it was cool. And I said, Lord, I'm not leaving this field until I have a vision of what you want to do in this place. Mm. And this church was founded in 1864. And I was here longer than any pastor after in my fifth year, because everyone wanted to get out of here. Mm. You know, they wanted to get on to a town church, not a little rural church.
Right.
And I said, Lord, I know that you have a vision for this church, for you're not willing that any should perish, but all come to life. And so I could picture that afternoon, I pictured a church with 3,000 people attending, which was crazy because the closest town is 3 miles and it has like had 6,000 people, Tip City at the time. And which was amazing, you know, because once we hit 3,000, we plateaued there for about 4 years because that picture was so big in my heart, you know.
That's amazing.
And I could picture a church that was multicultural. The Ku Klux Klan was still burning crosses in this area in 1979. It was all white. And so I had a picture that would be of a church that would be racially inclusive. And, you know, it's been exciting to see that our teaching pastor is African American. And by the 1980s, our choir director was African American.
Yeah, he's hot too. I've heard him sing.
Yeah. Yeah. We, on our Dayton campus right now, are it's almost 50-50. African American and mostly Appalachian white folk who came to Dayton to work in the automobile industry. I could picture a church that was socially active, you know, working with the poor and so forth. You know, Jesus' mission statement said, you know, that in Luke 4, that he came to proclaim the good news to the poor. And if it's not good news for the poor, then it's not the gospel. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I really, in April, had that vision. And so with that vision, I was willing to commit my whole life to be in this place. So I hit 30 years, and now my goal is to go the next 10 and then 10 after that. So if I can do 50, that would be tremendous.
50 years in one place. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Have a golden anniversary.
Well, and Steve, you know, I think one of the things that is so important is that when we really commit ourselves to one place, the results are exponential. Mm-hmm. And, it, you know, one of the guys in the church here tells me, he said, I don't know why you people ask you to go speak around the world and stuff. He said, I've been here all 30 years And you haven't done anything extraordinary in any one year. It's just you don't go away.
Yeah.
And you see that. It's like, you know, the second year here, I think our attendance averaged like 127. And then it went up to, I think, 184. Mm-hmm. And then it went up to like 294. And then it went up to like 330-something. And then, but then all of a sudden, after so many years, it starts becoming exponential. Yeah. Perseverance is critical in ministry.
Just stick to it.
Right.
Don't worry about it.
Yeah. Right.
That's just fantastic. Well, Mike, I know you're working on a book, and I don't know if you have a title for that yet or not. They tend to change as you work on projects, I know.
Yeah. Well, it's supposed to come out. I just finished it. It's supposed to come out next January. It's called Change the World. Rediscovering the message and mission of Jesus, and really talking about shifts that I see happening in effective churches today.
Now, I know we've talked a little bit about it. Let's talk about that for a little bit here. You've talked a little bit about the idea of missional versus attractional, or, you know, maybe putting into a question, you know, how do you see focusing on the cause versus the come and see approach as being different? Would that be a question that might fit there?
Yeah, Steve, I think you and I very much were influenced by the church growth movement. I mean, you and I, you know, met years ago at different conferences and seminars, and our churches kind of grew together. You know, you were in Cincinnati, I was here, and we watched each other and admired the Lord's work through each other. And we really came up in that model where it was about how we get people into the church, you know, and the seeker sensitive model, and the positive thing about the seeker model was that it reminded us that unchurched people matter to God. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it caused us to lower the bar to such a degree that in our attempt to be seeker sensitive, we forgot that this is a revolution. You know, a revolution of the kingdom of God.
Yes.
So I see that the shift is not so much about attracting crowds to the church as it is getting the church, those in the church, out into the world in mission. I kind of compared in the book to a cruise ship model. The attractional model was very much like a cruise ship. It was self-contained. And think of the wide range. You never have to leave a cruise ship. Mm-hmm. I mean, everything from coffee shops. Look at what we've done in our mega churches. And we have a coffee shop and coffee carts and a juice bar. We've done all that stuff. But we have a gymnasium. We have a basketball court. Think of all of the things that we have done in a church that you'd never virtually have to leave.
Right.
And very much like cruise ship programming. Cruise ship is based on a hierarchy. You know, there's a professional staff that serves the passengers. And in the church growth movement, we emphasized, one of the good things about church growth movement was it emphasized gift-based ministry and ministry of the laity. But we did so well in growing the mega church that it became basically staff-driven. Mm-hmm. By paid employees. Mm-hmm. And so you had a staff of maybe in some of the largest mega churches, hundreds, ministering to thousands of passengers, you know, who were doing most of the things. So it's not a very biblical model in that it really does the opposite of what we were trying to do with the priesthood of believers. Mm-hmm. You look at a cruise ship programming, it's about indulgence. You know, of all of the things we do for people versus kind of the sacrificial picture that is portrayed of in scriptures. Mm-hmm. My parents, man, they've been on like 19 cruises in the last decade. I mean, that's what they do with their friends. And I've never been on one. Have you?
No. I worked on a smaller boat, but it wasn't nearly that nice.
Well, and you know, the way they describe it, man, is there's so much food. I just feel bloated listening to their stories. you know, and my dad, he's 84 now, he said the reason he likes to go on cruises is he feels like one of the younger guys helping old people to the dining room. Well, to me, that's a little bit of what the mega church has become, is we've aged.
Yeah.
You know, and as I travel around to the mega churches and speak in some of these places that really thrived in the 80s and 90s, I'm noticing that they've aged with us, their pastors. Mm-hmm. And I've noticed more gray hairs, you know, as I approach 60 here than when I was in my 30s. Mm-hmm. So, you know, younger folks aren't so much attracted to come and the media and the arts and all the things we've done, and some of that's still important. I'm not dismissing it, but we put so much into having excellent music and media and dramas and so forth. You know, the younger generation is more concerned with making a difference in the world.
Right.
So one of the biggest shifts I see with that 18 to 35 generation, it's about what are you doing that's relevant in the community and the world? How are you interacting with situations of injustice?
More of the cause issue.
The cause. And so we're even finding today that evangelism is kind of happening the reverse of Rick Warren's baseball diamond, mm-hmm. is that most people begin to get involved with the people of Jesus through service. Mm. May later come through baptism, classes, worship, and so forth. I have a good friend, he's my dentist, and he takes teams with our church four times a year to Jamaica, even pays for his own staff to go. He's bought field equipment and so forth. Mm. As a result of that, he's gotten involved with three other men in my church, a doctor who runs the medical clinics and two guys who run our micro businesses. He's gotten involved in a small group Bible study with those three other guys who are part of this Jamaica mission. Mm-hmm. But he may only come to worship here two times a year. Hmm. You know, and so but here he's sacrificially using his resources, his time, and so forth to serve the poor in Jamaica, mm-hmm. which has led him to the relationships with these other Christian men in my church, mm-hmm. and now in a Bible study with those Christian mm-hmm. men. So I very much see that the church is going to be have much more an evangelistic approach that's missional rather than proclamational.
Yeah,
very much inviting people to get involved in causes, righteous causes outside of the church before they ever come in. So it's kind of like earning the right to be heard by seeing the way we love.
Yeah,
it's really what Jesus said. He said, "By this all people will know you're my disciples by the way you love one another."
That fits right into the second thing that you had mentioned in your book about decisions or disciples versus decisions. Is that right? A second.
Well, yeah, it is. And Steve, you know, really, what I saw in this last election year, I hate election years, because in election years, people in the church really show that they are more partisan and political than biblical.
Right,
and they allow their partisan ideologies to really determine their Christian theology, mm-hmm. instead of a good healthy Christian theology directing their political ideology, mm-hmm. and so the number of people who get involved, you know, in around a gospel message, but who never come to that place of stepping out side the walls of the church and really committing their life and resources to the gospel mission. Mm-hmm. And that created, there's been a tremendous discipleship gap. Mm-hmm. And I think it's time again to do what Jesus did. Every time crowds started gathering, he'd turn around and say something stupid. You know, like he would, like, "Man, if anyone wants to come after me and doesn't hate their brother, sister, husband, wife, their own life also, they can't be my disciple." What's that?
Stupid.
Oh, my gosh. Or, you know, "Anyone that wants to come after me and does not deny themselves and take up their cross daily." You know, it's about sacrifice. And so we have been honest with the costs.
Yeah.
You know, we do these simple little, you know, messages, series, and so forth, you know, about how Jesus can make your life better now. And we forget, go back to the cost of discipleship and what Dietrich Bonhoeffer said. Mm. You know, when Christ calls a person, he bids them to come and die, mm-hmm. you know. And I love Rick Warren's Purpose-Driven Life, where he said, you know, in that very first chapter, "Hey, it's not about you." Mm-hmm. You know, that's worth the price of the book.
Right there, that one line alone.
online, yeah.
Exactly. So we have really bought the American message versus the biblical message sometimes.
Oh, yeah. You know, we have assimilated the whole American dream. And it's the same thing. In 2005, I started saying to the church, you know, in 2005, America reached a negative savings rate. We were spending $1.22 for every dollar earned.
Oh.
And I said, this god of materialism, how long can this house of cards stand? Mm-hmm. And look at where we are today.
Exactly.
And it's what's now called the Great Recession. Mm-hmm. And who knows where this is going to end up. And mm-hmm. Christians have participated in this idol of materialism.
Yeah, certainly. Now, yeah. Mike, what do you mean by macro versus micro? I know that was one of your points, too.
Well, when I talk about macro versus micro, the church growth movement was really based in bigger, better, more. And mm-hmm. and the whole, you know, we were kind of mirroring our culture, mm-hmm. you know, like the Mall of America. Mm-hmm. I think you and I don't know if I was with you. I know we were in Canada together before. Once I was speaking in Edmonton, and I went to the Edmonton Mall, which is bigger than the Mall of America.
Oh.
And we bought into kind of that mall mentality, you know, and food courts and churches and so forth. And there's been a shift away from that whole mall philosophy of doing church, macro approach to doing church. And it kind of parallels culture. There's, you know, you go to malls that have been built in the last decade, and they're more outside boutiques. You know, separate little restaurants and shops. Instead of where our generation at one time preferred, we even took our children on days off to food courts and malls. The next generation preferred the Starbucks coffee, you know, kind of places. So, you know, the 18 to 35 year olds aren't looking for bigger, better, and more. You know, they're looking for smaller, more intimate kind of places. To have relationships. Steve, I see the same thing happening in business. We thought in terms of these Fortune 500, you know, kind of companies and General Motors and so forth. And, you know, the companies who are making it today came out of kind of the innovations of the younger generations and software and everything else that I think the total Google staff is under 100 people, I read, mm-hmm. you know, and that we're seeing more micro kind of organizations and movements having macro impact. Mm-hmm. And the old way of trying to start with macro, that you have to be bigger and better. Mm-hmm. So I see a whole shift in the church of rethinking bigger, better, and more. And again, having a more micro approach. So we even, Steve, have started house churches. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not talking about cell groups. I mean, you and I did cell groups, have been doing cell groups for, you know, the last 30 years. Mm-hmm. But literally, we're planting house churches where that is their church. Mm-hmm. We're doing smaller kind of venue kind of worship experiences. On Monday night, we have a church of 300 and some people. That they're all clients at our food pantry. Hmm. And they have dinner together every week, they have worship together every week, and they have communion together every week. Hmm. On Saturday night and Friday night, once in Dayton and once up here on our main campus, we do recovery worship celebrations. Our largest house churches right now probably have 20-some people. Our smallest have 6. Mm-hmm. So I see that we're going to really impact our cities, not by trying to be the biggest city church in the city, but by trying to church our cities.
Mm-hmm. Kind of like,
and that's not going to be macro, that's going to be micro.
Would you say building an atmosphere is really part of what you're trying to do? Building a larger-than-life atmosphere? Would that be part of what you're trying to accomplish, Mike?
Well, not in one place. I think it's building more intimate kind of atmospheres,
yeah, okay,
in multiple places.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like we've never built a sanctuary here, and we're not going to. Mm-hmm. And even though we average almost 5,000 people a weekend, we can only hold about 900 to 1,000 in a multi-purpose room.
It's interesting because as soon as you're done speaking, I've spoken at your place before. People start moving the chairs like clockwork. It's just boom, boom, boom,
right.
And the people are used to it. I think if you're a newcomer at your place, they're kind of probably sitting there going, what in the world's going on here? Because people, you stand up to, you go to sit back down and the chair's gone.
Right.
They probably sit down on their fanny on occasion.
Well, you know, we use the same space, which you really have to do to be good stewards of God's resources. It's the preschool playground. It's the preschool lunchroom. You know, we use it for our Wednesday night food court before Bible studies and so forth. And we have to really think about the theology of space and how we maximize. You know, as long as we keep building these multi-million dollar campuses, you remember last summer when gas went to $4 a gallon?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, okay, so, you know, a person's tithe, 40 cents of every dollar is going to go to maintain a facility. Next generation isn't going to get into that. That's not good stewardship.
No.
So one of the shifts in this from macro to micro is also from expansion. We would try to get bigger in one place, was the church growth movement, to multiplication. So again, the emphasis is going to be much more on planting churches. Well, and that's what we're doing.
Don't you call it mission to mortar? Is that something, your phrase?
Well, from mortar to mission, that instead of doing all these building campaigns and so forth to keep building facilities that will hold folks, like we did research, and it was going to probably cost us, even in a pretty simple way, to build a sanctuary for this congregation, somewhere between $12 and $24 million.
Oh, my word. Yeah.
So how much more? And I don't know, Steve, what did the sanctuary cost down at Cincinnati Vineyard?
Well,
we
got it before prices went up. We paid about $14 million.
Well, see, that's huge.
Yeah.
Right now in the economic situation we're in, if I was carrying much debt, we'd be in trouble.
Oh, yeah.
And yet we have a project in Darfur, Sudan, that we have about $4 million invested in. And we were able to just cut a check recently for $726,000 that we would have never been able to do if we had significant building, kind of debt.
That's beautiful. That makes Jesus happy, I think.
Ah, and we've been able to build 158 schools in Darfur, mostly in the refugee camps.
Really?
Yeah.
Schools. That is intriguing.
So that's what I mean, more of a shift from mortar to mission.
Yeah.
Is that we can maximize our minimize our money in brick and maximize our money in mission.
Yeah. You talk about budgeting missionally. Is that what you mean by that?
Right. I want to, Steve, I say when I do pastor training around the country, the way you budget missionally is you think in terms of your budget in three categories: mortar, and that's all your capital expenses, everything from utilities, debt retirement, any staff, if you have a janitor or more than one janitor, any staff that takes care of capital or facility needs. If you have vans or buses, insurance, any maintenance cost, insurance cost, that's all mortar, a line of the budget. Mm-hmm. So when you put all of your capital expenses in one category, cleaning supplies, everything, the next category is ministry. And ministry is all everything you do, staff and so forth, to equip the saints for the work of mission. Mm-hmm. So that's your children's programming, your youth programming, your adult programming, all of the support staff. To disciple those folks to do mission outside the church. And the third category is mission, and there's no self-benefit to mission. That's all of the money spent outside your church. Mm-hmm. So budgeting missionally is to make sure that that third column, that mission column, always is exceeding your mortar column or capital expense column. So last year, for example, I follow this closely at Gamesburg, we spent just under $800,000 in the mortar or capital category. Mm-hmm. That would include the 23 staff that are janitors and site team and maintenance on our facilities. Mm-hmm. It would include our $24,000 a month debt retirement on almost $2 million, mm-hmm. utilities, buses, all of that. We spent just in Darfur, doesn't count all of our other mission projects, $1.2 million. Hmm. In 08.
In facilities.
So, or, just No, just in mission, just in Darfur.
Okay.
So, see, my mission way exceeds my mortar. Mm-hmm. And anytime your capital expenses begin to exceed mission, you cease to be the hands and feet of Jesus in the world.
Yeah.
The ministry category is the middle category. That's probably going to exceed mission in most churches if you're growing.
It's no wonder that we're looked upon by the watching world, and we are just, they put their hand to their head and they go, there's no hope. I mean, where is the hope of the world?
Right.
And we are, and by the younger generation, the Gen X, Gen Y, Gen Y especially, and they are just wondering, you know, what happened to our parents and our older siblings? You know, they sold out and they're all mixed up, you know, so.
Well, we, Steve, we did a CCN broadcast, satellite broadcast from here on March 29th. And George Clooney, the actor, blogged on what we did here, and it was based on Darfur. Mm. And so on his blog, people jumped on and they went, what? Christians care about genocide and stuff that's happening in Darfur? Mm. So you see, the culture is shocked when we care about the things that are close to God's heart.
Right.
You know, like, what does Micah 6:8 say? What does the Lord require of you but to do justice?
Yeah.
You know, there's hundreds of verses that deal with justice in the scripture. Yet somehow we have allowed our culture to perceive us, as the book on Christians says, as judgmental, anti-homosexual. These are the three things they see us as hypocritical, are the three major. When you ask people, 18 to 35-year-olds, what's the church about? Judgmental, anti-homosexual, and hypocritical. Not how we love, how we serve, what, you know, positive influences we're having in our world and community.
It's all reactionary instead of positive.
Right.
Yeah. Wow.
Right. Like the Pharisees.
Yeah. We need somebody to write on the ground for us a little bit and do some drawings on the ground, names and so forth. You know.
Yeah.
But, Mike, you talk about multiplication versus expansion. And what do you mean by that? Can you expound on that a little bit?
Yeah, I think, again, is, and Bob Roberts down in Texas has done a lot with this, you know, work, is that, you know, we don't have to be the biggest church in the city, and to try to be the biggest church in the city is expensive. Mm. You know, so keep planting churches, keep moving people out, because the only way and it's a New Testament model. The New Testament model wasn't one big church in one place, but it was continually planting new churches. Mm-hmm. That's how we're going to church our cities. That's how we're going to church our country. That's how we're going to church the world. When healthy churches, large churches, don't kind of try to keep add numbers in one place, but they really use their resources and their people, you know, to plant new churches. When we planted the new campus down in Dayton, I asked for 80 urban missionaries who were willing to go from here to do that church. Mm-hmm. And they went. We had some meetings and training. They went in September, and now there's 80 plus from the community, an attendance of 264. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's what I mean when I talk about multiplication versus expansion. Mm-hmm. And, Steve, I think you know this too, is, you know, fewer people are anointed to lead megachurches, mm-hmm. Than those who are anointed to be effective pastors of 200, 300, 500, or 600. Mm-hmm. You did a great book a few years ago called The Pretty Good Church. You didn't call it The Pretty Good Church. I like that title. That was your first title.
Right.
And that's what you were saying, to raise up leaders who could do mission mm-hmm. in that church of 500 to 600.
Right.
You know, that was a powerful. See, I stole that idea from you.
Yeah,
I thought it was mine, but it was yours.
Go for it.
So that's what I'm doing. See, you influence people like me.
Well, you know, what would you say to people that are watching today that are leading the church of 100, 150 people, and that are wondering, you know, can I make a difference? And I'm the guy that sees myself as getting up to that point where I could send somebody off eventually, but I'm not there yet. And I just need a word of encouragement. I need a word of perseverance. What would you say to guys? Because a lot of guys are watching, and they're in that boat exactly right now.
Well, I think the most important thing you can do is disciple. And just like what I did here, I looked for those folks when I was teaching from the pulpit whose hearts were strangely warmed. And to steal a quote from John Wesley. And I invited them, Carol and I invited them into our home, and we began to disciple on Wednesday nights. And these folks became some of the initial staff folks at Gainsburg Church. One of them, John Ward, who's a businessman, 30 years ago he was in our group, continues to go out and lead the initial transition team in our church restarts. So he's done two church restarts, you know, in buildings that were ready to close, in at-risk areas. So he's led two church restarts, successful restarts for me in the last 5 years. And so what you do is disciple. You know, don't worry about the 90. Worry about the 8 to 12 in your church who want to dance. To the music of the Holy Spirit. Pour your life into those 8 and 12. I've never had a span of care more than 8 or 12. Right now, my span of care is my senior management team of 7 other people. So pour your life into the few and be willing to realize that it's going to take a lifetime. Be willing to invest your life in those folks.
It's almost like the sheep that Jesus went after, but you're saying it, instead of one sheep out of 99, out of 100, it would be a few more sheep than that, but going after the one, investing in the handful of sheep that would be your small group.
And I take them to great conferences, so this becomes the core of my church. We read great stuff. I remember in 1979 when I came here, we read Howard Snyder's book, The Problem of Wineskins. We read George Hunter's Contagious Congregations. We read Dietrich Bonhoeffer's Cost of Discipleship. So, you know, these are the people that begin to understand the priesthood of believers and that every follower of Jesus is called into ministry.
And they come over to your house and they grill out and they eat burgers at your house and use your bathroom and check out your medicine cabinet. Have you ever had that happen to you when you hear a big clanging sound and they go you in there and somebody's actually checked out your medicine cabinet?
I'm sure it has.
Trying to see if you have horns or not, or normal like everybody else is, you know. So
And I think you and I both know it is, man. When you're working, you know, in the ministry, the Lord's ministry, you're going to come up against resistance. Yeah. And all 30 years I've been here, there's been periods of resistance. 1999, we lost about 400 people. Last year, during the election year, we probably lost 300 or 400 people, you know, because we've always been involved with the poor here. But somehow during election years, when we talk about the poor, some of our folks think that's a democratic issue instead of a biblical issue. You know, they leave the church. So you're always going to have those kind of situations. And again, to remember, it's not about us. You know, we're here to please Jesus.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's hot. Well, Mike, this is very encouraging. This is just so life-giving today. And I think you've really encouraged a lot of people today that are going to be tuning in and watching this. You know, it's a little more difficult to watch something that's 35 or 40 minutes long, but I think to those that watch it, and there will be many hundreds. We know from experience that about 1,000 or 1,500 people watch these things, and I know it'll be absolutely life-giving and worthwhile for everybody. And so appreciate you taking the time to tune in with us here today.
Well, Stephen, I appreciate you and you know your faithfulness in ministry and your innovation. So you know. Pray for me, brother, when you think of me, and keep on keeping on.
Oh, it goes both ways. Thank you so much.
Okay, God bless you, man.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.